I'm Paul Lay, Senior Editor at Engelsberg Ideas, and I'm joined today, I'm delighted to say, by Tim Bouverie, who's won considerable acclaim for his new book, Allies at War, which looks at the relations between Allies during the Second World War and how they defeated Hitler. Tim, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me, Paul.
You won considerable acclaim for your last book, which was a study of appeasement. And this seems, or could be interpreted as a follow-up to that. I wonder what the motivation was in writing Allies at War.
Well, I think you're right. It is a follow-up, and it seemed to me the logical next book to write. I think that there is a general perception, not obviously among specialists, but in the broader public consciousness, that politics stops when war begins. But as we all know, from Clausewitz onwards, war is simply politics by other means. And it's complicated politics. And I wanted to show how complicated it was. Obviously, that revolves to a large extent around the big three, the Soviet Union, the United States, and the British Empire. But this improbable and incongruous alliance was, as I say in the book, exactly that. This wasn't the alliance that was meant to come into being at the beginning of the war, and only could have come into being because of the completely unforeseen event, namely the collapse of France in the summer of 1940. So the ambition for the book was to go beyond studies of just Churchill, Roosevelt and Stalin, and to look at anti-Axis diplomacy and politics in its entirety. And so I've got the first five chapters are on Anglo-French relations and the consequences of the collapse of that alliance in 1940. I look at important neutrals such as Spain, Ireland, Yugoslavia, Turkey, and then also that forgotten but hugely important member of the Allies team, nationalist China, which of course had been fighting the Japanese since 1937.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that's fantastic. I really like that panoramic aspect that you have there and these neglected ones. I mean, Ireland particularly, I was surprised by just how detailed you went into that. And also, as you say, nationalist China, which is often neglected. I also really appreciate the fact that it's this focus on diplomatic history. It seems to me very timely as a book in that with the peace dividend, we got used to a history that was obsessed by the marginal, by things outside the centre of gravity. But now, I think, in a world that's in crisis, that's fractious, that's become serious, this seems a book for our time because it deals with the big themes. It deals with politics, as you say, and it's great to see that diplomatic history back there.
Well, that's very nice of you to say so. I do think you're right. I think there is such a fascination with the Second World War in particular, but the military aspects of it, that there is so much that one could go into in great, great granular detail on military events and weapons that take place and why certain battles were won. But if we zoom out, we have to say that Hitler, Mussolini and the militarist governments of Emperor Mikonomiya Hirohito could not have been defeated if there hadn't been this alliance. How did it come into being and how was it able to sustain itself despite myriad contradictions? And then what were the effects of it? The title of the book, Allies at War, is a deliberate double entendre. These were allies who did share a fundamental military aim, but they disagreed on so much else, including how to prosecute that war and the sort of peace that they wanted to see derive from it.
And those alliances shift constantly, which you make very clear in that book. So let's go to the beginning of this, at least from a Western perspective, which is at the beginning of the war, it's expected. We have Britain and France as the principal allies opposed to Germany. And what was the thinking behind that alliance in 1939 there when we get into the phony war?
The thinking behind the Anglo-French alliance was sheer pragmatism. There was nothing romantic and nothing terribly idealist about it either. The British during the 1930s, as I discussed in my first book, had consistently resisted the French embrace. French politics in the 1930s is in a considerable state of disorganisation. Governments last, on average, 4 months between 1933 and the outbreak of war in September 1939. But all French prime ministers and cabinet ministers in this period of left, right or centre agree on one thing, and that is that they are not prepared to make any major step towards the containment of Nazi Germany unless they have the unequivocal backing of Great Britain.
Yeah.
And that gives Baldwin and then the Chamberlain governments considerable leverage. It places Britain in a leadership position.
Which, of course, is something you've touched on before in your previous book.
Exactly. And it is only when appeasement, which is an overwhelmingly British-driven policy, fails that the British are prepared to realign with the French as they had done in 1914, simply because there are no other options.
Yeah.
And it isn't a bad military option. The French army is the most powerful in Europe. The French Navy is the fourth most powerful in the world after the Royal Navy, the US Navy and the Japanese. This should have done the trick because it did do the trick for 4 years,
yeah,
or at least held the line for 4 years between 1914 and 1918. But it was not an alliance of idealism. It was an alliance of pragmatism.
Yeah, and it's fascinating. One of the really interesting things about this book, I think, and we'll deal with that collapse of France in a second, but it's full of facts. For example, I was amazed by the number of French soldiers and French military figures who wanted to be repatriated, for example. It's an astonishing figure, which tells you a lot, I think, about the difference between Britain and France in that alliance.
Yes, so this is after Dunkirk.
Yeah.
And at one of the meetings of the Supreme War Council, the already defeatist French commander-in-chief, General Végan, and other members of Paul Reynaud's cabinet turn on Churchill and demand why the French are being left behind. And Churchill makes a commitment that from now on, French soldiers will be evacuated on a 50-50 basis with the British Expeditionary Force. And over 90,000 French soldiers and airmen are evacuated from France. But then, as you say, once the armistice is signed and General de Gaulle is in England trying to rally support for a free French fighting contingent that will continue the war along with Britain, very, very few of these soldiers, sailors and airmen want to return to the fight. They want to be repatriated. They want to live under occupation or in the
Vichy.
Free zone under Vichy.
Yeah.
Because they, at that stage, they don't think Britain's going to win. That's a really important thing. And nor does the Roosevelt administration believe that Britain's going to win.
Mm. And this is an interesting point, I think, when we have this idea of Britain alone during this period, after the fall of France and before the United States enter into the war. Britain sees itself alone. Of course, it's much more complex than that because Britain has this vast empire. It's not just this little island. It is still a place of enormous power, however pessimistic the outside world might be about its chances of survival. But what it picks up during that period when it is alone, it picks up a moral authority, which I thought you were very interesting on there.
I think the moral authority is really important, and it leads to some actions which result in military disasters, like, for instance, the British decision to intervene in Greece in the spring of 1941. This is because, or one of the reasons for it, is because the Chamberlain government has made a guarantee to Greece, has said that if Greece is invaded, Britain will come to her aid. And at this time, when the British Empire is alone, showing that Britain can still project power beyond the home counties is incredibly important. And showing that Britain will stand by her allies and is not going to be defeated. You mentioned the empire, and the empire is incredibly important, but it's actually not taken into consideration by outside players in Britain's predicament because they don't see that Britain can rely on the empire to win. They think that Britain will think, because France, of course, still had its empire intact, and there was a very viable alternative to the armistice, which was for the French government to continue fighting from North Africa. France hadn't taken that option. Britain might not too. The British might reach the conclusion that the German high command took in 1918, which is we should try and save what we can because we cannot actually win this war. Whereas Churchill's view is, I don't know how we're going to win this war, but all I know is that we're going to carry on fighting this war until we come up with a strategy to win the war.
And you place that moral authority on Churchill.
I do. I think that there are so many things that Churchill can get wrong and does get wrong, and I'm critical of him in the book, but the decision to carry on and the sense that history is watching and that Britain is going to continue this fight. And he frames it then as a great moral crusade, obviously with the view to trying to bring in the United States. He says, if we fail, if Britain loses the Battle of Britain, and that stage he doesn't know, it's just going to be in the sky, it could have been on the landing grounds as well.
Yep.
If we fail, the whole of Christian civilization will be at an end. And I do think that rallying Britain, rallying the British Empire, and thereafter rallying as much of what we would later call the free world is his greatest achievement.
Yeah, and he really employs history in that narrative that he uses to rally, that rallying narrative in brilliant prose. But he calls on a deep sense, I think, of English providentialism there as well, that there is this idea that despite the odds, it will prevail because it has to be good over evil. There's a kind of Manichaean aspect to Churchill's speeches at that point, I think.
Yes, there is. There are very few prime ministers who are actually as non-traditionally religious as Churchill.
Yes.
Someone later said this to him in the war. They said, "You're not terribly religious, are you, Prime Minister?" And he said, "I think you'll be hard-pressed to find someone who's created more bishops than I have." But he's not religious. But yet, in these speeches in 1940, he is constantly referencing the divine until the United States, in God's good time, will come in and rescue the old world. And I think that is really important. The continuity of British history is something that unites left and right. As I say, the only people who aren't behind Churchill in 1940 are really a very, very thin, lunatic fringe of the far left and the very far right.
Yeah, and it's like T.S. Eliot's a great poem of the Second World War. The fire and the rose become one. And in that unity, Churchill inspires them through language. It's almost as though his religion is Englishness, actually, rather than anything else. That's his religion. But you mentioned there, and also, just before we get on to the next alliance, there's a ruthlessness about Britain as well, which I think we see, is it July 1940, Marcel Kabir?
3rd of July.
I mean, that is a tough decision and a ruthless act.
This is the decision of the British cabinet to sink a large proportion of the French fleet at Marcel Kabir off the North African coast. And Churchill is very keen to do it from the start. And again, talking about him thinking historically, he says that this will have a terrific effect on British morale and likens it to the Royal Navy's sinking of the Dutch fleet by Nelson during the Napoleonic Wars.
Yeah.
It is obviously primarily a military decision. As I mentioned, how large the French Navy was, if Britain was going to survive a German invasion, it could not allow the French fleet to fall into German hands. And there were viable and honourable alternatives given to the French Navy. They could sail to America, they could join the British in the war against Germany, they could scuttle their fleet. The British, and particularly the naval commanders on the spot, were extremely reluctant to open fire.
There were men crying.
There were men crying. And the man in charge, Captain Holland, tried to resign from the Royal Navy in the days after Marcel Kabir. But Churchill also realised that it was important to show the world, and in particular the United States, which at that stage was holding back on military aid because they didn't see the point of giving military aid, which was just going to go to the Germans because they thought Britain might sue for peace at any moment. It was important to show that Britain was prepared to do absolutely anything to survive. But what's never been shown before, and what I found very exciting in the course of my research, was that the British government actually asked the American government effectively permission before they opened fire on the French fleet. I just found a one-line telegram in the Roosevelt archives at Hyde Park in which the British ambassador, Lord Lothian, wrote to FDR on the 4th of July and just said, "Mr. President, you will see that Winston Churchill has taken the action with regard to the French fleet that you and I discussed the other day and you approved." Yeah. And that was... There aren't always exciting moments in archives, but that was one of mine.
No, this is terrific archive work. I think that's one of the really interesting things, and one of the great achievements of this book is the use of the archives. It's really genuinely original in that, and I think that's its significance, or part of its significance. The UK-US alliance you describe as the most successful military alliance in history, I remember. That comes into being Pearl Harbor. What is the great success of it? Why is it? Why can you use that description of it?
purely on what it achieved, these joint operations, for all the squabbles, for all the prima donna-ish
generals. And there were squabbles, you detail those.
There were major squabbles, and there are major military squabbles, which I don't go into because this isn't a military book, but there are certainly squabbles about grand strategy. This is an alliance which works together to clear the Axis from North Africa and Western Europe, as well as the Atlantic. So it's the largest achievement. It's the most collegiate. It's the most integrated. There is genuine comradeship. There's a fantastic story, which there's some suggestion it might be apocryphal, but it certainly summed up Eisenhower's attitude. Eisenhower is the perfect soldier, politician, diplomat. There is nobody, I think, who could have done a better job of leading a genuinely allied military effort than Dwight Eisenhower. And when he's planning Operation Torch in London, in St. James's Square...
This is North Africa.
This is in North... Yes, the invasion of French North Africa, scheduled for November 1943. He hears that one of his subordinates has said to a British staff officer, he has called him a British son of a bitch. And Eisenhower sacks him on the spot. And the British officer who's been called a British son of a bitch is appalled, and he goes to Ike and says, please, this seems really far too harsh, because actually we British have learnt that you Americans really use the phrase son of a bitch as a term of endearment. It's sort of part of the course. And Eisenhower says, that may be, but he called you a British son of a bitch. That's what I object to. My ruling stands. But it didn't stop some very, very major disagreements, and a potentially catastrophic one, which I go into some detail in the book, and I don't think is so widely known, which is the breakdown of atomic cooperation between the British and the Americans, which, at least according to one or two members of the Manhattan Project, delayed the completion of the atomic bomb by anywhere between 8 months and a year.
There are a number of splits, as you mentioned, between UK and US, and there's particularly one over empire. What is the truth about that in terms of the American approach to the British Empire? What do they object to?
The American objection to the British Empire is twofold. On the one hand, it's an idealistic moral objection. America sees itself, saw itself as a former colonial power and disapproved of colonial empires and approved of, and this is particularly true of Roosevelt, who is the great idealistic descendant of Woodrow Wilson, the principle of self-determination, the right of people to be free and to determine their own form of government. So there is the moral idealistic angle to American anti-imperialism, but there is also the more selfish and, dare one say it, avaricious angle on this. The Americans in those days were very anti-tariffs.
Yes.
As opposed to now.
How times change.
Cordell Hull was obsessed with the issue of tariffs, and particularly the system of tariffs known as imperial preference that had been installed in the 1930s that protected the British Empire, a free trade system, a customs union within the British Empire. Yep. And the Americans, again, it's idealism on the one hand, and it's a more pragmatic, commercial, and indeed selfish point of view on the other. Free trade, they believe, leads to a reduction in international tensions and therefore reduces the chances of wars. On the other hand, America is by far the world's most powerful economy, the world's leading creditor. All of these natural resources, which are being used to the advantage of the British, Malaysian rubber, Middle Eastern oil, everything that is freely and readily available to the British will come on the open market, and it is the Americans with the unrivaled power of the dollar that will be able to benefit from this.
Yeah, and there's a tremendous asymmetry, isn't there, that is recognised by the British. The British know about the asymmetry of power there. And I think I love that phrase that I think you quote, a pleading relationship that they had.
It was a pleading relationship because the Americans, to use a phrase which has been brought into vogue more recently, held most of the cards.
Yeah, yeah.
Before Pearl Harbor, but then that after as well, the Americans did drive a very hard bargain. And part of this, this is not an anti-American book at all. I think that Franklin Roosevelt is one of the great presidents. I think that what the Americans did in the Second World War was noble and absolutely necessary in the grand scheme of things. But on the one hand, the Roosevelt administration had to demonstrate was still very sceptical and isolationist United States, which, by the way, really didn't have any great a priori love for the British, except for culturally. The amount of scepticism of Britain and Britain's war aims and British imperialism, Britain's class system, the idea that the British were always scheming, they were always devious. This lasts right up to the end of the war and even into the early stages of the Cold War. Truman's advisors are saying, don't let the British drag you into a confrontation with the Soviet Union. This is what the masters of the subtle arts of diplomacy, the British, who have been doing it for centuries, are always trying to do. The Roosevelt administration believes they have to demonstrate to the American public and to Congress that Britain really is in dire straits and that Britain is prepared to sacrifice everything to survive. Mm. And so they drive a very hard bargain over destroyers for bases. Britain gives up 99-year leases on colonial possessions in the Caribbean and the North Atlantic in return for 50 antiquated, pretty useless destroyers. And then before Lend-Lease is even enacted, Britain has had to absolutely drain its gold and dollar reserves. An American warship comes to the Western Cape of South Africa and carries away £42 billion worth of Britain's last remaining gold reserves, an action which Churchill likens to a sheriff coming to collect the last assets of a hopeless debtor. And then British companies, British direct investments in the United States are, at US Treasury insistence, sold for half their value.
Mm. And it's a huge, what's also impressive about the United States, I mean, not just the United States, but it is the main player in the huge logistical effort that fighting the Second World War becomes.
Absolutely. The food which kept the Soviet army from starving was Spam made in Minnesota. The trucks which carried the Red Army from Stalingrad to Berlin were American-made. And Stalin recognised this as well. It is at one of the Allied conferences that he makes a toast to American industry, without which the war could not have been won. But this is slow to come. The British aren't, they don't quite understand the disconnect between American economic power, or actually not such great economic power. America is still suffering the effects of the Depression in 1939, and what America became. At the beginning of...
In a very brief period of time.
Very brief period of time. But it's the fall of France that causes Roosevelt and Congress to ramp up American military spending by a massive factor. But before that fact, Romania had a larger army than the United States in 1939. The US army, I believe, was the 19th largest at the start of the Second World War. So the logistical factors, and particularly shipping, which is hugely important for the Anglo-American war effort and indeed for the Soviet war effort, because so many of the American supplies, or indeed all of them, have to begin their journeys in ships.
Yeah, and we have the Arctic convoys, of course. And of course, we come to the third leg of this extraordinary alliance, which is the Soviet Union. And one of the things you seem to say is that Stalin is in many ways the winner of this war, that he is the one who comes out of it with the most. And I was really struck by some of the comments in the book about British support for Russia and Britain's high regard for Russian sacrifice, which, of course, was immense. And I think there's a quote from Churchill where he says that the alliance with the Soviet Union, which begins in 1941, of course, made Britain a trifle pinker. It had all kinds of ramifications, that alliance.
It did have a huge number of ramifications. And again, like the Anglo-French alliance, but even more so, it is an alliance of convenience.
Indeed.
A pragmatic one. And I think it's very interesting that Churchill is so welcoming of the Soviet Union, because more than anyone else, probably in the West, certainly in Britain, he is the anti-Bolshevik crusader par excellence. He is the man who famously wanted to strangle the Russian Revolution at birth. And yet he makes his broadcast after the onset of Operation Barbarossa, saying that Britain, and it was just Britain then, this is before Pearl Harbor, this is before the Americans are in the war, saying that Britain will give Russia all aid in her power. And he makes this broadcast without consulting the cabinet or the king.
Yep.
Britain has suddenly become the ally of a power and of a man that was in alliance with Hitler and the Nazi state between August of 1939 and June of 1941. It's an incredible turnaround of policy. And what I think people aren't very aware of, but I do go into in the early stages of the book, is quite how close Britain came to going to war with the Soviet Union in 1939 and 1940. There is a huge amount of pressure on the British and the French to aid the Finns when the Yep. Soviets invade Finland in the late autumn of 1939. And then there are all sorts of other plans developed, some of which get quite far in the operational planning, even to the extent of sending reconnaissance flights, which imagine or plan the bombing of Soviet oil wells in Azerbaijan. Mm. There's almost a cavalier attitude to, well, we're fighting the Nazis now, we might as well fight the Soviets. And part of this is ideological. Yeah. There are people like Evelyn Waugh who writes in the Sword of Honor trilogy that the real enemy is Asiatic, atheistic, Soviet Bolshevism. And how can we be claiming to be fighting a just war when we're only fighting fascism in Europe? We should also be fighting communism, particularly as they're allied. But then there's also this desperate strategic clutching at straws that the British can't think of a way, and the French won't allow them to a certain extent to think of a way of attacking Germany. But it might be quite easy to attack the Soviet Union, which, after all, has gutted its armed forces and through the purges of the 1930s.
And what about the American perspective on the Soviet Union and the relationship between Roosevelt and Stalin?
The American perspective, in many ways, is similar to the British. They take slightly longer, the American public, to be convinced that the Soviets are their great allies. If you want to know who the ally is that the American public respects and admires the most throughout the war, it's none of these powers. It's China. The American public believes that the ally they have most in common with and most admire, according to opinion polls time after time during the Second World War, is nationalist China. And that, we can talk about that later, is based on a fallacy. But Roosevelt comes swiftly to the same conclusion that Churchill does. And it's rather amazing that the amount of political hand-wringing and strategizing that has to go on before Lend-Lease is created for Britain, a fellow democracy defending the Atlantic sea lanes that lead to America, that takes an enormous amount of political agony. But the decision to extend Lend-Lease to the Soviet Union after Operation Barbarossa comes relatively quickly and relatively easily. And unlike Britain, which is forced to accept that it will repay, because it's not going to literally have the tools to give back to the US at the end, and that this will include the dismantling of imperial preference, the ending of this tariff system, Lend-Lease went to the Soviet Union without conditions nor expectations of repayment. And then this is when the alliance starts to shift, because Roosevelt, who is a fantastically successful politician, easily the most talented politician of the big three, who has managed to win the presidency now three times, despite not having any legs, and that is not a frivolous thing to say, that's a deeply impressive achievement. He comes to the idea that he can, and I quote, handle Stalin, and he asks Churchill to let him handle Stalin. He says, I can handle it better than you, better than your Foreign Office, and better than my State Department. Roosevelt completely sidelines his own Secretary of State, the State Department. US ambassadors and emissaries during the Second World War frequently complain that they learn more about what's going on in Allied diplomacy from their British counterparts, who have kept very well informed, than they do from their own State Department. And thereafter, we see Roosevelt moving away from Churchill and towards Stalin, or more specifically, trying to curry favour with Stalin by flaunting his differences with this Victorian, imperialist, in some ways slightly ridiculous British figure, Winston Churchill, causing the British Prime Minister great anguish at Tehran and later at Yalta.
Mm. I thought that was fascinating, the portraits of those three, and particularly the relationship between Roosevelt and Stalin. In the West, we think of the Second World War dates as 1939 to 1945, but you mentioned nationalist China there and the high regard in which it was held in the United States. 15 million people died in a struggle that began in 1937. It's easy to date the Second World War from 1937 to 1945. And you concentrate on nationalist China for parts of this book, which I think is a very impressive part of that global panorama. Just tell us something about that relatively little-known struggle that nationalist China is involved in.
In some ways, one could say that it begins in 1931 with the Mukden incident, when the Japanese sabotaged part of the Manchurian Railway and used this as a pretext to seize Manchuria. And then we get into another reason why the Americans disdain the British and disdain British diplomacy, because it is the British Foreign Secretary, Sir John Simon, along with the French and others, who fail to rise to the challenge of this great test case for the League of Nations. Now, one can say that's quite hypocritical of the Americans to get all worked up about that, because the Americans have refused to join the League of Nations. But nevertheless, the Chinese are viewed as an anti-imperial power, and they are believed to be, by the US, and are constantly told, a fledgling democracy, in contrast to all of these empires which dominate the rest of East Asia and Southeast Asia. This is not the case. The nationalist government of Chiang Kai-shek is a venal, corrupt, quasi-totalitarian, cultish, incompetent regime, which nevertheless suffers a staggering amount. I mean, the Americans and the British get a tough time in my book, and a tough time by contemporaries, for their racial attitudes and prejudices, frankly, racism in Southeast Asia. But it's as nothing compared to the Japanese concept of themselves as superior overlords and the atrocities they committed in Southeast Asia, particularly against the Chinese. By the time of 1940, the nationalist Chinese have been driven far back to a line in Western China and have had to center their efforts on Chongqing, this city high above the Yangtze. And thereafter, the front line doesn't move very much, which causes an enormous amount of frustration in British, but particularly American military circles later on. But nevertheless, one has to recognize that the Chinese were holding down some 600,000 Japanese in this theater, Japanese troops which could either otherwise have been sent to fight the British in India or the Americans in the Pacific. So it is a significant effort, but I think it plays to a bigger theme. There is one of the themes of the book is that I think the greatest policy failures occur when the statesmen fail to appreciate the true nature of the regime, the political system, or the person with whom they are trying to deal. And the Americans fundamentally misunderstand Chiang Kai-shek and nationalist China, and this leads to bitter disillusionment towards the end of the war, the so-called Stilwell incident, when General Joseph Stilwell falls out with Chiang Kai-shek and Chiang Kai-shek insists on his withdrawal. I think Stilwell's a pretty objectionable figure and he brought a lot of this on himself, but this leads to serious American disillusionment. And then that feeds into the later issue, which goes beyond the scope of this book, of who lost China? How was it that the Americans allowed the communists under Mao Zedong to defeat the nationalists in the aftermath of the Second World War?
We've talked about the combatants here, but I think another aspect of the book that I really appreciated, and this comes back to this theme of diplomatic history, which it is the way in which the combatant nations, the Allies, dealt with neutral countries, and in particular Spain, Franco's Spain, and Ireland. Now, you've written a really excellent article for Engelsberg Ideas on Sir Samuel Hoare and his work in Franco's Spain. But there's also the diplomacy with Ireland, which is important, particularly from a British perspective as well. I wonder if you could talk about that.
Certainly. The relationship with these neutrals is very different. Each neutral differs. Franco's Spain is ideologically sympathetic to the Axis. Yeah. Franco would like to join the Axis, but he can't, for the simple reason that Spain is economically devastated and militarily devastated by the Spanish Civil War, which has raged for 3 years, and that thanks to a healthy dose of British pragmatism, what the Americans even criticised at the time as appeasement, he is being supplied by the British with the grain and oil without which his regime probably couldn't survive, and the Spanish Civil War, through the sheer desperation of the Spanish people, may have reopened. So a very careful game of carrot and stick, but mainly carrot, goes on between the British and the Spanish in 1940. And I think this is really crucial. If we're talking about Hitler's great mistakes, Reich Marshal Goering said in his cell at Nuremberg that Hitler's greatest mistake was not invading the Soviet Union. He said Hitler's greatest mistake was not following up the fall of France with the invasion of Spain, closing the door to the British, to the Mediterranean, yeah, capturing Gibraltar, and then using the western bases of Portugal and Spain as U-boat bases to destroy Britain's Atlantic lifeline. And yeah, I think that's a very plausible thesis, and yeah, it's certainly one that worried the British. Ireland is different. The Irish don't have any particular affection for the Axis, but nor, for very understandable historic reasons, do they have any particular affection for the British. And neutrality is seen by the Irish, and particularly the Irish Taoiseach, De Valera, as the ultimate expression of Ireland's independence from Britain and the British
and
Empire.
And recently gained independence.
Very recently gained. And in particular, the gain of the treaty ports, which are these major ports on the west coast and southern coast of Ireland, which Neville Chamberlain surrendered in the same year that he signed the Munich Agreement. Churchill called this another improvidential act of appeasement. And the British do consider, or at least threaten, seizing these ports by force or just using them, but then realise that, again, this comes to the moral considerations. That Ireland has an enormous amount of support in the United States, and if Britain needs the United States, it cannot antagonise the US by behaving in a heavy-handed, imperialist manner in Ireland. So actually, the more serious offer that the British give the Irish is to end partition. They make an offer saying that we will coerce the Protestant counties of Ulster to join you. We will cut them adrift if you agree to enter the war. Now, there are lots of arguments about whether that was practical. The Irish, Northern Irish, the Protestants would have probably preferred civil war than to be coerced into a union with Catholic independent Ireland separate to Britain. But it's an offer that never gets that stage because De Valera won't even consider it.
It's fascinating reading this book in the light of current events. We see the shifts in alliances, misunderstandings between allies often, the personal relationships between leaders and politicians and diplomats. Does it have lessons? I hate to try and force relevance on a book, but there's resonance, I think, is perhaps a more useful word. When you look at the world now, what do you think resonates from your work to the current state of the world?
I think there are two main things. The first thing to say is that this is a book which attempts to be new and inform people about aspects of the war which are less understood or misunderstood by highlighting allied disagreement as well as allied cooperation. And yet the cooperation was utterly, utterly vital. And I do keep coming back to the Winston Churchill quote in my mind, which I think has great relevance for today, which is that there is only one thing worse than fighting with allies, and that is fighting without them. And I think that it is very, very easy to break alliances apart. It is much harder to put them together again, and people need to remember that, particularly in the United States. Secondly, a cold, hard look at the actual character of the regimes. And this also is a theme, I think, that carries on from my first book on appeasement and the men, and it is mainly men, that are running them. The level of illusion and delusion that the British and possibly to an even greater extent the Americans indulged on the question of Stalin and his territorial interests, his desire to communize Eastern Europe, how possible it was to come to accommodation with him, and the extent to which the personal relationships, the fact that they clinked glasses at Tehran or in Moscow, could somehow have an effect on the geopolitical stage is something to be extremely wary of, and I think has deep resonance today. And very finally, I would just say, going back to this moral point, there is an obvious irony in the fact that Britain and America were only able to defeat fascism by being in alliance with communism, and that one form of totalitarian oppression in Eastern Europe was replaced with another form of totalitarian oppression, one marginally and latterly greatly less deadly. I think when people ask about Poland, you could say at least Allied victory, which included Soviet victory, halted the Holocaust, as devastating as that had been up to that point. But nevertheless, there was an element of Allied or Western strategy about fighting a just war, and this did have an effect in rallying neutral nations and in rallying resistance movements in occupied Europe. And the British and the Americans were able to do that by, as far as possible, in their own terms, the Soviet alliance notwithstanding, to hold up the principles of democracy, liberty of conscience, the four freedoms that Franklin Roosevelt outlined in his 1941 State of the Union address: freedom from want, freedom of expression, freedom of worship, and freedom from fear. The freedom to live in a world where you are not at threat of greater nations swallowing smaller nations, and the law of the jungle being the law of international politics. And I think that we should underestimate at our peril the West being cavalier about these sorts of principles and thinking that this isn't going to have long-lasting ramifications for Western standing and Western geopolitics, as well as any moral considerations.
Well, thank you, Tim, for giving us a flavour of your book. And Tim Bouverie's book, Allies at War, The Politics of Defeating Hitler, is published by Bodley Head and it's available now. I highly recommend it. It's a major achievement. So thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Paul. It's been a great pleasure.